Episode 22, April Mowell, WA6OPS. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm your host, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG. My QSO today is with April Mowell, WA6OPS from Fullerton, California. I stumbled upon an article on the internet about how hams very effectively help hospitals that have communications blackouts when their telephone or PBX systems fail due to maintenance or power failures. I never really gave it a second thought until I read about what our guest did in her community to organize local hams to provide this critical communication. For over 30 years, April and her group continue to provide this important public service. WA6OPS, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, April?
Good evening, 4Z1UG. Eric, this is WA6OPS.
Thanks for joining me on my QSO today, April. QSO Today is about ham radio stories, and this one is about your ham radio story. I know that we'd like to take a deep dive into your pet project, the Hospital Disaster Support Communication System. But before we do that, can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story?
Sure can.
When and how did you become involved in amateur radio?
Well, I kind of married into it. I didn't even know amateur radio existed until I started dating my husband, K0OV. And we were both in college at the time. And actually, on one of our dates there in Nebraska, he drove me out into a cornfield, believe it or not, where he worked at a country western station, working his way through school. And he had 40 meters. He had a little rig that he had with the vehicle. And there we were on a date in the gravel parking lot of this radio station. And we were actually listening to 40 meters. And that was the first acquaintance with amateur radio. And I thought it was a pretty neat hobby for him. He was very smart. He was in engineering. And I thought that was a nice hobby for him. And a couple of years later, we got married, came to California. And, you know, he put some equipment, you know, in the second bedroom and an antenna on the roof. And it was a nice hobby for him. But it wasn't until a couple of years later, actually almost 7 years of being married, where I started getting a little frustrated because he had a timer on the radio in the shack in our house at that point. And that was so I could hear him on the radio when he was coming home from work. And then I started realizing, gosh, if I needed something or wanted something, I don't even know what to do. I can't even pick up the radio and ask for it. And then, of course, having been through a little shake and bake here in California with some earthquakes, I also realized, oh, great, I've got all this equipment here. What would happen if we had an earthquake right now and it was really bad? I can't help anybody else, much less myself. So that started me thinking about wanting to get into the hobby. And then what really topped it off was one night we were out coming home after dinner on a Saturday night, and he had the radio on in the car, and I was hearing people giving bearings, you know, 130 degrees this and so forth. And I'm going, what are they doing? And Joe said, well, they're on a transmitter hunt. I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, you know, they're somebody's hiding with a radio and they're trying to find it. And that intrigued me. That sounded like a lot of fun. And I said, well, is that something we could do like together? And he said, oh yeah, most folks hunt as teams, you know? And I thought, well, wow. So that, on top of the earthquake, being afraid of emergency, not being able to talk to him on the radio, that finally was the impetus to try to get into it. And I actually went through the Fullerton College. They actually had a course at the time, about a 6-week course where you could get an amateur radio license. And I used Joe as my mentor. Uh-huh. And that's kind of how I got into it at that point.
Well, that's great. About what time was this? What year was this?
Oh, that was back in about 1975, and I finally got licensed in 1976.
And the transmitter hunt that you were hearing was the Orange County transmitter hunt?
Yeah, I'm not sure which hunt it was. I just remember it was on a Saturday night, and but there was must have been some cooperative aspect to it because people were calling out bearings.
Well, I have to tell you, I was on probably every Saturday night Orange County transmitter hunt from about 1973 through about 1977. So it's very possible we might have met in those days.
I'm pretty sure we did because
on top of that hill in Orange, right?
Well, that
was the starting point.
Didn't you hunt with Dean?
I would hunt with Dean, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I would hunt with anybody. I actually used to go when I was in high school, before I even met Dean, I used to go with, I think it was WB6FAT, Milton Ronnie.
Oh, yes, I remember him very well. He liked raisins.
So I would go with he and his son, Paul, every Saturday night through high school. And boy, that was great fun. So how about that? So we might have met at some point 40 years ago.
I remember Dean having someone with him on a couple of occasions. And actually, we might have hunted you at one point.
I think we hit at near Rio Hondo College one
time.
That
sounds very familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
that was so.
Yeah. Not that I would run into you on the street today and go, "Oh, I remember you."
I'm much older.
But
anyway,
I'm sure we met. Yeah.
Do you remember what your first rig was? Did Joe buy you a first rig?
Drake TR-33C was my very first rig, and I thought that was cool. You know, it was the size of about a grape nuts box. And it had, you know, a shoulder strap. So that I thought was really, you know, great stuff to be able to have that slung over my shoulder, and I could walk around with that. And I actually kept that at the hospital with me when I worked at St. Jude in Fullerton at the time. And I had that with me all the time.
So that was actually, as I remember that rig, that was like the size of a little mobile radio now with a battery pack in it. It was kind of a luggy talkie on 2 meters.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that's amazing. And so therefore, your favorite operating mode is and has been VHF FM?
Well, it's the one I'm on the most. If I had my druthers, I suppose I'd do a little more HF because I do enjoy 10 and 15 meters. It just seems that I never get a chance to do that because I'm always, you know, busy doing something with the disaster group and things are on VHF and UHF most of the time. So I'm on some net or I'm coordinating some drill or whatever. But so it's, you know, as I said, I don't get to do HF very much just because I'm off doing other things so often. So what I'm doing the most, yes, is VHF, UHF, FM. But I like, you know, I like the tea hunting and I like HF when I get a chance to do it. And I enjoy our disaster group folks. So it's nice to be able to talk to them on the air.
Since you've been involved in ham radio for almost 40 years, does it play a role in your family life?
It is our family life. I tease sometimes about how it's not a hobby anymore. It's a lifestyle. Joe and I are both in it, and we're both equally involved. A lot of couples, the husband and wife, they're both hams, but it's one of them that's the primary ham, and the other one kind of goes along with them type thing. And we're somewhat unique in the sense that we each have gotten very involved in the hobby. We each have sort of our own identities, Joe with ARDF, tea hunting, and me with the hospital communications. And then we have our coupleness. You know, it's a lot of the things we do together. I help Joe with the ARDF stuff, and he helps me with the hospital group things. So it's, you know, we have one whole room in the house that's all amateur radio stuff. And so it's, as I said, it's as much a lifestyle now as anything. It's not just a hobby anymore.
Do you have children, and did they become hams?
We do not have children, but we do have B1RD in the other room, our cockatoo, and he knows a lot of the disaster group members.
Uh huh. And B1RD stands for, oh, that's his name.
That's Bird.
B1RD. Oh, B1RD. Yeah. Okay.
His name is Romeo, but, and they hear him in the background a lot of times when we're on our Tuesday night nets, or sometimes even during drills. He'll hear the activity in here, and he'll start. You know, he wants to be a part of it. and he knows a couple of the members very well by their voices, and he, you know, he talks to them on when I'm on the phone with them, and then he thinks he has to be on the phone with them too. But and we had some of our parakeets over the years have actually imitated the Morse code ideas on the repeaters, which was pretty funny. You'd hear them imitate it, you know. It's pretty funny. So that's what it is in terms of family life with us. Yeah.
So, April, so what is the Hospital Disaster Support Communication System, or HDSCS for short, and how did it begin?
Well, let me tell you with how it began. I think that's probably easiest, and you want stories, I do stories. I was working at St. Jude Hospital in Fullerton, and I'd you know, been licensed about not quite 3 years at the time. And I'd always thought of emergency communications being my radio, and I had my amateur radio emergency service card, and we'd been through a little introductory course at Red Cross, and so it was sort of like in my head, I had what I needed to do if there was an emergency. Well, lo and behold, one day, in my area of the hospital, I worked in rehabilitation, physical disabilities and rehabilitation, and all the therapies were in the basement. And lo and behold, we didn't have any phones. And I was a department head at that point, and people were coming to me and saying, April, we don't have any phones. We don't have any phones. So I thought there was something maybe just local to our area of the basement. And I started to walk up the hall to go to respiratory therapy and check with them, and started seeing other people coming out of their various areas going, do you have phones? Do you have phones? And then I realized we might have something serious going on here. And it was like, oh my gosh, I've got my radio. So I went to my office, grabbed that TR-33C, and started to head. I had to go two wings over to get to where the PBX was. And that was also up a floor above where we were. And I felt like the Pied Piper, because I was collecting people along the way who were following me, you know, from different departments to go up to the PBX to find out what was wrong. And when I get up there, I'm asking them, you know, what's happening? And they're saying, we don't have any phones. We have nothing. And it was like, I'm thinking, now what do I do? And I realized that ARES card didn't do a whole lot for me because I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. Here I was in an emergency. So I decided, well, there is a repeater. That's the ARES repeater that the Red Cross used. And so I got my Drake TR-33C, went out front of the hospital, and jumped up on that repeater and made a call for help. And lo and behold, there was a member of the Anaheim Radio Club, and that was their repeater, who came up, and he knew me, fortunately, and, you know, what's happening, April? And I said, you know, I'm out front of the hospital, and I said, we don't have any phones. And he said, goodness, okay, I'm going to try to get you some help. Well, lo and behold, over about the next 30, 45 minutes, people started showing up out front of the hospital. And, of course, also by that time, I'd been indoors briefly to talk to the hospital administrator to let him know what I was doing. And people started showing up, and a few people I knew, but there were also a number of people I'd never even seen before. And some people had a lot of stuff with them, and some people had very little with them, you know, just the radio that they were carrying. And one guy came with a whole suitcase. Fortunately, the phone outage only lasted about 2 hours, and during that 2 hours, people had been coming, and with help from the house supervisor, the head nursing person in charge of the hospital during the day, and she was helping decide where people would go. Now, fortunately, as I said, it was over in about 2.5 hours, and during that time, some good and bad things that happened from my view. Fortunately, it wasn't obvious to our hospital people, is that somebody's batteries failed shortly after they got on assignment, but that was right around the time things ended. And there were clearly people that were unfamiliar with you know, what to do in the hospital setting. And so while I was thrilled that these people came and the hospital administration and nursing people were, you know, wow, April, this was neat. I was a little concerned because I'm thinking, wow, we have these people here, but some of them, I have no idea who they are. And some people had good preparation, some people didn't. And so that was twirling around in my brain, clearly, of this was a good thing, but somehow it needed to be better than that. And the next day when I'm in my office, suddenly the charge nurse from the emergency department comes in and plops down in the chair and says, April, we have to talk. And I said, yes. And she said, I'm the head of the disaster committee for the hospital. I said, okay. And she said, I want to know more about these radios. I want to know more about these people that showed up. She says, we have to find a way to get this into the disaster plan. And I was like, now what do I do? And so it was basically we were learning from the ground up because there really wasn't much out there when you talk about the end of 1979. Yes, there were stories about hams helping in various emergencies, but there was nothing other than sort of the overall ARES umbrella. There was nothing that said how you really put all of this together. And the ARES structure in Orange County, I talked to our EC at the time, and I said, what happens in the disaster? And he said, oh, well, we'll go to St. Jude. I said, but they don't know about you. So it was like the hams were planning things, but the agencies that they were talking about going to, other than Red Cross, didn't know who they were. And I thought, well, that's not good because, you know, we're protective of our patients and we don't want just anybody coming into the hospital. And they might not have, they might be perfectly good people to help, but if the hospital doesn't know who they are, they might not let them in, you know. And of course, people came in that day because the hospital people knew me. And so their assumption was I knew who all these people were. So that really led me into getting together with the local leadership and, you know, talking about how we need to make this into a group where we can do some training and special preparation for what it's like to come into the hospital. And that's, and then I immediately got appointed as an assistant emergency coordinator. And we started really literally from the ground up supporting St. Jude Hospital. And I then was asked to come to one of the disaster meetings that other hospitals were at. And that same charge nurse who was the disaster committee chair for our hospital, she was chairing that overall group that there were numerous, there were like seven other hospitals that were part of that group. And she says, now I want you to talk about, you know, what you did. And I want you to talk about how you can help the hospital. And of course, I'd been well vaccinated in ham radio by being told you've got it, you know, PR is important. So talk about it any chance you can. So this was my opportunity. Of course, I didn't realize that I did too good of a sell job. And when that meeting was over, every one of those hospital coordinators that was at that meeting were coming to me and saying, April, how do we do this for our hospital?
So this was even before you had created a plan for your, you know, for your organization.
Exactly. It was it was that incident that moved us very rapidly into that. And we had to find a way because the other hospitals were going, we don't have an April at our hospital. How do we do this? And so we, you know, I sat down with, you know, again, of course, Joe was involved with me at that time. And in terms of ham radio and being married, all that good stuff, and some of the other, you know, people in the local area. And I'm trying to figure out how do we find ways, how do these hospitals alert us and so forth if they have a problem. And over time, we ended up with what we referred to as the call-up system that we had, and each hospital that we support, and of course, now we support 34 hospitals, and that changes sometimes monthly, sometimes yearly, because hospitals are buying and selling, closing, reopening. And we have some of that we know is going to happen this next year. But at the moment, we have 34 medical facilities that we support. And that does include all of the acute receiving hospitals. Those are all of the paramedic receiving hospitals in the county. And every one of those facilities came to us and said, we want amateur radio in our disaster plan. We want HDSCS to help us, to support us. So we have a call-up system that they have, each hospital has, and it's unique to their hospital. And it gives four names for daytime, weekdays, four names for evening and weekends. Those are initial contact people. Those aren't necessarily the people that respond, though often that might be a responder. But they know how to contact those individuals. If, say, they called me right now and my phone's busy, they go to the next person on the list. And they call that person. They get their phone machine. They call the third person. He's there. He takes the message from the hospital as to what the emergency is. And now the ball is in our court. That ham then activates the system. If he or she is not a coordinator, they contact one of the coordinators. And we activate our members to go to that hospital. So you have to have an activation plan, not only for how does the hospital get a hold of the hams, but how do the hams activate one another. And what we've learned over time is that in order to have a good response to the hospitals, we have to know who's generally available at that time of day in that area. Orange County is pretty big, if you remember. We don't want to be calling somebody from South County down in Mission Viejo for a hospital emergency that's up in Fullerton. Not to be an initial responder, it's going to take too long. So we actually have what we call first wave sheets that our coordinators and our what we've developed as our select call people. They're the ones that are likely to get a call from a hospital. And it's basically my brains spilled out on paper these days because I know everybody's situation in terms of where they live, where they work, when they tend to be available. And so if somebody gets that call from the hospital and they have to help activate, they go to that first wave sheet and it says, oh, for St. Jude, these are the people I should call first. And those are going to be people who live or work at that particular time of day somewhere in the north end of the county, somewhere near Fullerton. And they're going to be relatively available in terms of they can leave work or they can leave home. And there's at least six names on that first wave. If we don't get the number of people we need in that first wave, there is a second wave. Once we've used that up, then everybody's fair game in the group. But I can't think of a time where that's happened yet, because usually initial response into one of the hospitals for a single hospital incident is going to be 3 to maybe 6 people max, depending on the size of the hospital and what we're hearing in that initial, you know, activation by a hospital. In addition to that, we also have on that call-up sheet a pager number that the hospital can use. And each and every one of the facilities that we support, along with a couple of ambulance companies and County Emergency Medical Services, has their own unique 3-digit code. So we tell the hospitals, if you can't get a hold of us on the landline, you know, can't talk to somebody in person, or if something is so urgent, like you're getting ready to evacuate your facility because of a fire or something like that, some kind of evacuation, you don't want to waste time trying to call people. Just dial up that pager and put in your 3-digit code. That is like magic. If they try to put in their cell phone number or something like that, and we tried to call that, it would likely be busy because they're calling somebody else. Or if their lines are intermittent and we try to call the number they've put in, which might be one of their hospital phones, it might be down. And you know what? We're dead in the water because we don't know what that phone number necessarily matches up with. All we know is we can't get through. But if we get the 3-digit number, that lines up with a specific hospital or EMS, we at least know who's in trouble. and we can head out. We can still try to call as well, but that three-digit number has been crucial on a couple of occasions, because if we hadn't gotten that, we might not have gotten to the hospital in as timely a manner, or not at all. Now, some people say, well, you know, what happens if there's no phones? Well, usually if there's no phones at all, that's going to be some kind of area-wide situation. That's what we've referred to as a core team response, and that's our automatic response. Now, we don't encourage any group or any individual ham to just go off and respond to a hospital unless they're part of already an organized group and they're already part of a plan. And that's the issue here with our hospitals, is we're in that plan. So they know that we might come and check on them in a major incident. In fact, they want that. If they don't need us, they'll tell us when we get there, and then we can go someplace else that might need us. But if the earth shakes, if we determine that there's a power outage in a particular area, and we try to call a hospital, we can't get through, you know what? We go and we check on them. And that's happened on a number of occasions.
April, if I was to play devil's advocate for a minute, because obviously we're now in a period when everybody carries around a cell phone. Here in Israel, it used to be people might carry two cell phones around. In an era of the cell phone, why wouldn't hospital employees just use cell phones between employees in order to supplement or to make up for a PBX system that's down?
Well, sometimes they do. We're not the one and only alternative, and hospitals do these days plan for the use of some cell phones. However, unless you know everybody else's cell phone, you want to talk to the third floor, you want to talk to the nurse on the third floor. If you don't know her cell phone number, how are you going to call her?
Also, right, so they would have to be as organized.
They would have
organized.
To be far more organized, because to track down everybody's, you know, cell phone number. Mm-hmm. Cell phones, of course, as radios, they run on batteries. Once your cell phone goes down, now what? And that's why our amateur radio operators that are part of our hospital group do a lot of planning and preparation in their disaster boxes. They have a lot of redundancy in terms of additional battery life and power. We tell them that they should have at least 6 hours of battery support in their initial go kit, and hopefully more out in their car if they needed to stay longer. So that's certainly one of the key issues, is that the cell phones, unless you know everybody else's phone number, you've got the battery life issue as well. So those are two real issues. And then you have the issue of dedicated communicator. I was a patient care person and I worked at St. Jude. It would be very hard to be taking care of a patient and be listening to your radio at the same time, and handling messages coming to you. A lot of times we forget that the communication paradigm is not only transmitting, but receiving. And our value to the hospitals has been as much in our ability to receive information for them as it has been to transmit something on their behalf. They love the fact that we can listen for them. And when it comes to that nurse in the intensive care unit, they don't want to be tied up with a radio. And in fact, I remember in one phone outage, I was assigned to an intensive care unit. And when I got up to that intensive care unit, I'm holding my HT with me, I suddenly realized there's a nurse walking towards me rather quickly. And as she gets closer to me, she shoves this walkie-talkie in my face that says, "I don't know how to use this. Will you take this?" That had been brought to her by a security guard. She had no idea who she could talk to on it and didn't know what she was supposed to do with it. And she had patients to take care of. She didn't want to have to be walking around without that radio. So what we bring to that situation is that addition of, we are dedicated to the communications task. We can sit there and listen for you in case anything comes your way. And if you need something, we will send the message out. And when we are doing that, I'll tell you, the nurses keep track of us. They watch us like hawks. And you stand up just to stretch, and it's like, where are you going? And that's because they know if they've lost their phone system, sometimes they've lost their paging as well. And that was true in that case where I was in the intensive care unit, as they lost all their overhead paging. And I was going to be the only way that they knew if there was a code blue in the hospital. And of course, there was one of the code blue team members is on the intensive care unit. There's always an ICU nurse that was part of that team. And he or she wouldn't know to respond if they didn't have me, you know. So that's the additional value added that we bring that a lot of hams don't realize. Because sometimes they sit and they'll go, well, I didn't do much. I sat there for 2 hours, you know, wherever, and they only used me once. When it comes to a hospital, it doesn't matter whether you handled one thing for them, whether you sat and listened, and when they asked you a question, you updated them on this is what's happening. They will still think you're pretty heroic because you were there and you freed them up to go about their duties as a hospital person, a patient care person, a lab person. They were freed up to do that without having to worry every minute about what if I need the phone.
Mm-hmm. How often is your group activated?
On average, we've been activated about an emergency call out about 4 times a year. Now, in addition to that, we also do about a similar number of what we call standby operations. The hospitals over the years have learned that we're pretty nice to have on hand, quote unquote, just in case. So when they're doing additions to their phone system, they're adding a new building, and now they need to add that new building onto the phone system, and they have, bring some phones down and then bring them all up again. Even when they're going down for a power upgrade and they're going to be running on emergency power while they're working on the power system, they like to have us there just in case, because phone systems have gone down when they've been working on the phones or working on the power. And it doesn't matter if you have a UPC or anything like that. Those have failed at hospitals. And so those are usually done at odd hours, like, oh, April, can the hams come in at midnight and be with us till 6 in the morning? And believe it or not, we have a great group of folks, and we have our night owls that are happy to stay up. And fortunately, we have some of those early birds that are willing to be up at 3 or 4 in the morning, and they'll relieve the night owls. And we have some folks that say, hey, I'm good the whole night, so put me on at midnight and I'll leave at 6. Of course, we also prepare for if things aren't done at 6, we always have some people ready to go. But so that creates some additional activity for us. And, you know, the standby operations are great training. Most of our folks are not hospital people. And so having the chance to be in the hospital anytime for a drill or a standby operation gets them more comfortable with the environment. They interface with the hospital staff. They get to see what that's like. And they hear some of the language. And when they have to go in for real, it's not as scary for them. This is a group of folks. We have our newbies that go through a little bit of that initial scariness, but we usually have them mentored by our folks that have more experience, and our folks do amazingly well. And the feedback I get from the hospitals is typically something like, I don't know why they call you folks amateurs. You're so professional. Well, that says a lot. And the other thing that says a lot is that when we've gone in a real situation, a common comment that they make is, oh, April, these folks were wonderful. They knew just what to do. I'm a hospital person. If you read between the lines, that also means they knew what not to do.
Amazing.
They knew how not to get in the way. They knew what to listen for. They're proactive listeners and proactive observers. And that makes a big, big difference.
How do you deal with privacy and HIPAA? Can you first explain what HIPAA is, and is this an issue that you deal with in the hospital with your group?
Oh, absolutely. It's something we educate our folks on. And it's something that when this first was about to come out, one of the hospitals in Orange County had their risk management team do an extensive review of. And part of that review was, hey, we have these amateur radio, this organized amateur radio group. What about those people and handling any messages?
Can you explain what HIPAA is and how it affects the hospital?
Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And HIPAA came into being primarily because of electronic medical records and all of the computerized data on hospitalized patients. And so first and foremost, that's why HIPAA exists, is to protect hospitals and the various so-called covered entities, which is anybody that takes care of patients, could be a doctor's office, could be a pharmacy, whatever, is they're supposed to have ways to protect their electronic information so that somebody can't get into their computers and get people's social security numbers, get diagnoses and elective procedures that may have been done to them and why they were in hospitals and things like that. Now, the thing to understand about when the ham radio operator comes in, he's been invited in by the hospital. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we're coming in an emergency, we've been invited in. We are now an agent of the hospital. The hospital is still the primary responsibility for any information that goes out about a patient. HIPAA understands that emergencies take place, and they allow for that. And in fact, if you read, and we have that information on our website, by the way, if people go to that, hdscs.org, there is information on HIPAA. We have a white paper that we wrote, and have given that out to the hospitals, the radio operators, anybody that has a concern about it. And our hospitals are all very comfortable with it at this point in time, because what is it, if we're involved with a hospital, there's got to be some emergency going on. And HIPAA does say if you have to give out information that's involved in care for someone in an emergency or is involved in notifying relatives about this person being in the hospital, that is okay to do because it's an emergency. And you always give out the least amount of information necessary. The media can get information almost any time they want, unless somebody's come into the hospital and as they're admitted says, I don't want anybody to know I'm here or whatever, and they sign off to that. But a hospital can typically find out that somebody's been admitted to the hospital. They can find out their basic condition, whether it's serious or good or fair. So there's a lot that can be given out on a daily basis, even when there's not an emergency. We're involved when there is an emergency. And if the messages we're being asked to handle are related to patient care, the hospital's okay. And we're okay because we're part of the hospital. So it's not as big a deal as some people make of it in terms of amateur radio. And if hams are concerned about it, it's because they don't, one, understand it, and they haven't had training with the hospitals to understand it. That's why we've done well, is because it helps that I'm a hospital person, but it's the fact that they've reviewed the information. As I said, one of the hospitals here in Orange County did an original review that involved us that said, hey, if the only time they're doing this is in an emergency and it's involving patient care, we're fine. And who's responsible for that information going out over the air? It doesn't go out over the air until the hospital person gives it to us. So as long as the hams are, as long as the only time they'd be concerned, and we counsel our hams about this, is we don't give any information out after we leave the hospital, certainly. So as long as there's no patient, identifiable patient information, that's the way the one hospital put it. As long as there's no identifiable patient information that we would be giving out after we leave the hospital, there's really no concern. But people have to be trained and know what they're doing. But we don't send out a message about a patient and patient care unless a hospital person has given it to us and it's been authorized to go out. We teach our hams, though, I'm a big stickler for them understanding all these things. But I always tell our hams that one of the things the hospitals look to us for is that we're kind of advisors as well as we are communicators. And before we send something out that has patient information in it, we always try to remind them, just understand we are on the radio and we can't guarantee, you know, that somebody might not hear this. Right. And the decision by the hospital people is the urgency versus the confidentiality. And those decisions have been made. We have had real instances where we have had to give some rather pertinent information out over the air. And the hospital people were advised and they've said, this needs to be done right now. We've had to do an emergency call for a physician to get in for an emergency C-section. And we had to give the name. You know, the doctor has a number of patients. And so we were going to have to give the name out over the air. And the way the ham that was involved with this tells the story is that he said, you know, April, he said, I advised that nurse that, you know, we might not be able to guarantee confidentiality of the name. And he said, she practically pinned me against the wall and said, I don't have time for that. Just handle it. just do it. So that's April, what makes the difference.
So April, let me ask you a question. What's in an HDSCS go kit? What do you advise your members to have in their go kit?
Oh, goodness, that's a long list. And again, we do have some information on the net for people or on the website.
Yeah, I'll put that up on the show notes page.
Okay, so good.
They can click on the link and they can go look for that.
Great. First of all, we do use, and this is part of developing some confidentiality as much as we can provide in amateur radio, is we have three different bands that we use. We use 2 meters, 220, and 440. And the minimum requirement in our group is that people at least have 2 meters and 440 capability. And the majority of our members now have all three. And that gives, so when they put their go kits together, we encourage them, of course, to have whatever radio and radios that they have, the handheld versions or anything that they can quickly get into the hospital with. The idea of the go kit is we want them to be able to get into the hospital quickly, establish some communications back out with the net control, you know, get something out to the world outside to let us know how bad things are. Are we going to need more people or whatever? Now, at some point, they might need to go back out to their vehicle to bring in more stuff, but we need them to get in quickly and establish some kind of communications. The other thing in terms of that go kit, having their small handhelds with them, is almost 80% of the time that we respond to a hospital in emergency, there is at least one internal communications link the hospital wants us to establish from unit to unit, you know, from floor to floor. When it's a receiving hospital, every single time we've ever been called out, they have somebody that's at PBX or the command center, and the second ham goes to the emergency department. That's always been the case with the receiving hospitals. And then from there, it might be ICU and so forth. So we need our people to have their to be portable, flexible, adaptable, so they can go where they need to go. While some hospitals do have antennas that we can hook up to, and occasionally some hospitals install equipment, I can tell you probably 60% of the time, only 60% of the time might we end up being able to use that. Because the nature of the incident is such that they can't go there. Or if it's a single hospital incident and it's a phone outage, you know what? They won't disrupt that hospital physician's meeting. But in the same room where they tend to have their command center, so we can't go in there and hook up to the antenna, even though we've got an emergency in the hospital. So we've got to establish our link somewhere else. So in addition to those handheld portable radios, we need them to have things like folding J's, something they can create as another antenna. Mm-hmm. That saved me one time being in the basement of the hospital in pre-op area, and I'm in the middle of the hospital in the basement, And it was a good thing I had my folding J, because I was had to get up on a chair and hook that into the acoustic ceiling so I could be heard by the other stations in the hospital. They need to have at least 6 hours of, you know, battery support. They need to have some kind of an earpiece. We don't want our radios to interfere from a noise standpoint. We don't want that to be a distraction. We also want our hams to not be distracted. And if you've got that little earpiece in your ear, you're pretty likely to hear somebody calling for you. If you've just got the radio sitting on the desk there at the nursing unit, you've turned the volume down so it's not too loud, guess what? You're likely to miss a call. Or if it's very noisy in the emergency department, you're likely to miss the call. So we want people to keep that little earbud in or little headset in. So we want them to have that with them. We also don't want our hams to become part of the problem. So a little bit of personal preparation is important. If you take medications, if you're likely to get hungry, hospitals will feed you at some point. But if you've come in at 5 a.m. while there's a phone outage, you may not get fed for a while. So you better have, you know, a little granola bar or something like that, your own little thing of water. In the midst of the emergency, you don't want to be pestering the nurses. Can I get a drink of water? Don't think that they're going to, you know, get you the aspirin that you need for your headache. So a little personal preparation. So some of those real, real basics are crucial. And hams over time have their particular preferences as to connectors. Some of the hospitals, the antennas they've put in have been at different points in time. Different people have installed the end fittings. And so we've learned to have, the various different kinds of connectors to have, because you don't know until you know, the different hospitals. As I said, you need to be prepared for the different hospitals you might end up at. Some people think, oh, well, I'm primary for X hospital. Well, that's true. But if there's an emergency at a single hospital, and that's not your primary hospital, but you need to go assist there, you better be prepared for the SO239 that they use there.
Do you carry like message blanks?
We do. We have...
So you have a procedure for passing messages, and you record them and keep copies?
Well, keep in mind that there's something here called the Hospital Incident Command System, which the majority of hospitals are now starting to use across the country. It was first developed here in California and developed by somebody in Orange County, I'm proud of to say, a gentleman by the name of Paul Russell. And he ended up becoming a ham just so he could put up with us, I think, at one point. He was the pre-hospital care coordinator at Mission Hospital, now in Mission Viejo, when our group first came into being. And he was so interested in that and wanted his hospital to have it that was the first South County hospital that requested HDSCS. So we had one South County hospital and 13 Central and North Orange County hospitals. Mm-hmm. But he then became ultimately over time the medical disaster management coordinator at County Emergency Medical Services and became KD6 COP. He ended up involved in writing at the time what was called Hospital Emergency Incident Command System, which by the year 2000, I think, got brought up by the feds. They changed it to the Hospital Incident Command System. And that's now put out for all hospitals around the country to use. They don't have to use that one, but it's FEMA and Joint Commission, people that accredit hospitals, that approve hospitals, and so forth. You have to have some kind of a command structure that you use in an emergency. And
this includes the way that
bring with them. The hospitals have it, but we have our hams bring it too, because in the midst of the chaos when our hams might be arriving, it's a big help if the ham already has the sheet with him. And it's called a HICS 213, and that's the form that's used by the hospitals for any kind of message. So we have to kind of adapt to that. In addition to that, we developed our own form a number of years ago to make sure that our hams were prompted to get the most important information, you know, to and from, of course. What's the precedence? How important is it? Because our net is always up kind of a giant party line. And if you're on with more than one hospital, is your message more important than what you're hearing on the air at the moment? Because that's going to prompt them when to jump in. And so they know to ask the hospital people, how important is it? What's that precedence? What's the priority? And then one of the things we've learned, thanks to a member of our group who helped design some of the ordering systems for one of the large pharmaceutical distributors, we've learned how crucial it is when pharmaceuticals have to be ordered or any medical supply, how important it is to have a national drug code number, a universal product code number, or even a manufacturer number. And in the case of pharmaceuticals, an NDC, that national drug code number, is like magic. And so if a hospital needs to order some more ampicillin, for example, and they don't have any more in their pharmacy, and they've got to get a message out to another hospital, to the supplier, or to EMS if they can't get anything from the other two options, if that NDC number is on that message, they have a very good chance of getting it efficiently and getting it accurately. So while we want all the, what's the name of the drug, how much do you need, all, you know, the quantity, the dosage, all that, and that NDC number, that's almost like an error check. Because if you look up something like Valium, there's like 2 pages of Valium for every single dose, every single type of, whether it's injectable, whether it's IV, whether it's a tablet, a capsule, a caplet. And so that NDC number matches up with each one of those. So if you want 10 milligram injectable Valium, and you say how many doses you want of it, you'll have an NDC number that's going to match up with that 10 milligram injectable. And that's why it's such a great error check. And that's what we've been teaching our members, is you get that extra information. Sometimes the hospitals go, why do we need all of that? Because if we get that, then we will be able to, we're less likely, far less likely, to have the message come back for more information. It's amazing. Really great. And so we've learned to ask for those things, and that can make a big difference in the real emergency when you have to get those real items. And even if your primary supplier can't get it for you, that NDC number is known by anybody that'll supply that. And so if EMS gets the request for that 10 milligram injectable Valium, and they send that up to the state, or they send it out of the region somewhere, it's got that NDC attached to it, you're going to get what it is you asked for.
Does your organization use any of the digital modes to do either file transfers or message handling, in text form?
To be very brief, and then I'll explain, the answer is no. And the answer is no because we've been doing this for almost 35 years now, and we have not yet found a use for it. Now, part of that is because how do we make sure that all 30-some facilities would have the capability for us to do that, those digital modes, and to all of the various people that we need to talk to? Hospitals don't just talk to other hospitals. Hospitals talk to city EOCs. Hospitals will talk to doctor's offices. They will talk to various suppliers. They will talk to county EMS. So whatever is used, it has to be common to all of the people we might have to communicate with. And the other issue, as part of being common, is we have there's in and out over time, but we roughly have about 80 people in the group. We'd like to have at least 20 or 30 more, which hopefully we'll get to. But you've got to have everybody be competent in whatever mode it is you're going to use, because you don't know who's going to be available at any point in time. And just because you have one or two gurus in your group that are good at Winlink or that are good at IRLP or that happen to have D-Star, do we have everybody in the group that can do that? No. I have to tell you, to be honest, in amateur radio and hams that might be listening, if they're honest with themselves, they'll nod their heads. How many hams out there are even that good with their own HTs that if they get told to go on the output of a repeater to do something, can do it? We'll know what to do. Uh-huh. A lot of people get their radios and somebody programs them for them, or the computer programs them for them. And now the repeater is down and you're telling somebody to go, you know, said the repeater's down, go to the output of the repeater. I don't know how to do that.
So this means that you, as part of your group then, you've established maybe a channel lineup order of the channels that you're using perhaps?
Oh, indeed. Yeah, we have repeaters, specific repeaters that are available for HDSCS use. And that's true with the various groups here in Orange County. And the beauty of that is that the organized groups, the various city RACES groups, Red Cross, county RACES, hospital group, we know what repeaters the various groups use, what simplex frequencies they use. And so we have probably the best example of interoperability, I think, of any place in the country. Because if my hospital in Fullerton needs to talk to the city EOC because they need fire support, they need a generator, we can tell our radio operator, you're cleared to go to Fullerton RACES frequency. That hospital radio operator leaves our net, goes over and checks in with the Fullerton RACES group on their frequency, handles the traffic on behalf of that hospital, and then comes back to our net. Then that hospital says, we need to talk to the Red Cross. We have a blood request. Guess what? We clear him from our net, and he knows where to go now to find the Red Cross.
Training is really the training is the key here.
Training is key, and ham radio training isn't just a once a week net check in. Training isn't just field day once a year. It's got whatever agency you support. Obviously, I'm a hospital, but whatever agencies you support, you need to understand how that agency works. You need to understand a little bit of their language. We're not able to teach people every single medical terminology, but in their little manual, they do have a glossary that has some of the more common terminology that they're going to likely see or hear. This sounds funny, but to say that patient is SOB on admit is something they might hear, might be something that they're asked to transmit to the floor, to the floor.
And it has nothing to do with their mother.
That's right.
Right.
It means short of breath. But you don't want the ham is going to feel pretty silly and would be embarrassed if he's asking that nurse, are we really supposed to say that he's an SOB? So that's the kind of thing we do, is we want to make sure that they know some basic terminology so they can be what one of our members used to refer to as intelligent intermediaries. That's why the hospitals like us, trust us, feel comfortable with us. That's why we get the comments of, you guys are professional. Why do they call you amateurs? It's because we've worked at it. And it's because on our nets every week, we do things where I'll spell out phonetically things like ampicillin, terms they haven't maybe heard that are medical. And that's to help them realize how important the phonetic alphabet is, because things can sound real different over the air. And there's a difference out here between medics, Mike Echo Delta India X-ray, which is the ambulance company, and medics, Mike Echo Delta India Charlie Sierra, which is short for our paramedics. And that's something that can get confused if you don't know the context and you don't know, or things aren't spelled phonetically. Even things like amoxicillin and ampicillin can be misheard over the radio. So we want people, that's the kind of stuff we'll train for on our nets, at our meetings. We bring in hospital people to our meetings to talk about various departments. We've had lab people come and talk about some of the most common laboratory tests that get ordered. Now, certainly we also teach the value of, when possible, when it gets messy, like an order for the lab, or maybe even a pharmaceutical request, third-party traffic. Just put that microphone up in that nurse or doctor's face or whatever and let them talk. But if they don't have the time, they may not do that. They'll want to write it down, and you've got to grab them by the sleeve, make sure you've got the right information. But I want, that's going to bring me back to this issue of the digital communications. You know, most of the communicate, I know people get concerned about, oh, long list of names, and, you know, what about these long list of supplies? At the point that those things typically come into play, you're way into the, you're many, many hours into the disaster at that point. And at that point, you may have other resources that are able to help out. But most importantly, the messages that we've been asked to handle over 35 years have been relatively short and almost always tactical. We need a respiratory therapy stat. Or EMS is asking us for the hospital status in terms, what's your patient care capacity index or inventory, PCCI? And what they want to know is how many immediates, how many delays, and how many minors, meaning walking wounded. And so the hospitals are going to come back with a very short, 2 immediates, 4 delays, 10 minors. That doesn't involve all the technical stuff that goes into doing, putting up the WinLink and so forth. And technology is changing so rapidly that, you know, 20 years ago, packet was the gee whiz thing, and it was, why don't you have packet? Well, now hardly anybody, at least that I see out here, is using much packet. And if they're doing anything, it's more along the WinLink line. So not to say that those might not have some value in certain selected applications, but in all honesty, I can't recommend them for hospital use. It's overkill, and unless you have everybody trained in the use of those things, you can't guarantee that somebody's going to go in there and know how to use it. And also, when we've seen people having, I can think of, and the hospital will remain unnamed, but I know of some hospitals where they've, you know, at the, they've put, installed a station, and they have packet and WinLink, and they have 2 or 3 bands of, you know, VHF, UHF. You're going to have one operator that's going to operate all those things and be able to pay attention to all those things. You can't assume that you're going to be able to have more than one. If you have a multi-hospital incident or any major disaster, your first priority is to get at least one person there to talk to the outside world. And if you're going to expect that person to try to work packet and be on voice, and the thing is, they've got to at least be on voice, because that's going to be the common communications in the area, first and foremost. And the others, they're going to try to do, and they're not going to be able to do both. So, you know, I'm very much of a realist. And to say been there, done that, well, we haven't had the 7.0 earthquake, but what we've had has been enough, thank you. And we've certainly had a multi-hospital incident. We've had the power failures. We've had the serious phone failures, where phones have been down for over 20-some hours. And we've been in internal communications as well as communications to the outside world. And hospitals are better prepared now for going to the outside world than they are for the inside world.
April, we're at the end of our time, but I want to thank you very much for coming on. I have to tell you, when I first discovered you online, I was looking at what you were talking about with the issue of a PBX system going down in a hospital. It never occurred to me in 100 years that this could be a major problem for a hospital that their phone system is down. Well, of course it is, but it doesn't seem obvious.
Well, let me quickly
and
share. Let me quickly share with you.
Sure.
Hospital phone failures occur far more often than you would ever know, or that what hospitals would ever want you to know. Now, fortunately, the majority of them probably only last 2 to 4 hours, but you don't know when a code blue is going to happen. You can't say, oh, well, the phones were only down for 2 hours. They wouldn't have a code blue during that time. Code blue, a life-saving, you know, situation. Mm-hmm. Somebody's in cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest. I've been in the hospital. I heard 2 code blues within 15 minutes of each other one time. We were in a phones down situation one time, and there were 2 code blues called within 30 minutes while we were there, in the first 30 minutes that we were there. So you can't assume that a phone outage is not serious, because I know there are people, I know there are hams that think that is not a serious, that's not a real emergency. Only an earthquake, only a hurricane is a real emergency. Not if you're the patient, not if you're the family member of that patient, and not if you're the person taking care of that patient. That is serious. They don't care why the phones don't work at that moment in time. Point is, they can't get what they need for the patient. And that's why I want people to pay attention to the fact that supporting hospitals is important, and that just because you haven't heard that there's been phone outages at a hospital doesn't mean they haven't had them.
Well, we have a situation over here in Israel with the hams, and that is that everybody assumes now that because of cell phones and because of rather elaborate telecommunication systems that the army has, or that the police have, or that the emergency services have, that hams aren't necessary. And this is kind of the feeling that that many of the hams here, and even in the national organization here, is that we're not needed. And what you've pointed out here is that, and maybe because hospitals tend to be business entities and, you know, private
right.
entities,
mm-hmm.
that there's a lot less red tape to go through to be able, as a ham radio operator, to add value to your community. And you've really opened my eyes to this idea that, in fact, even here, if we want to play an emergency role, that we just go to the local hospitals who are just like your hospitals there, and I'm sure around the world this is also true, that we can play an immediate role, and that role doesn't require all the things we've talked about, like the digital modes and stuff.
No.
It requires training and an HT,
yeah.
and the other things
backup,
that go in the code kit,
yeah,
and
yeah.
some
and
backup,
a good go
right?
Kit.
But
yeah.
but it's not highly complicated. And it's highly valuable. And
it is highly valuable.
That's my takeaway from this.
Yes, I'm grateful for that, because I know I get a little passionate about it. I get on my soapbox, as you can tell. But that's because we've seen it work.
April, I want to thank you for joining QSO today. I appreciate your taking time from your very busy schedule. I know that it took a while for us to schedule this interview, and we started at 6 a.m. my time in order to be able to get you on in the evening your time.
I appreciate
I'll provide
getting
links.
Up early.
I'll provide links in the show notes page at www.qsotoday.com to the very excellent website for HDSCS. And just search for April or WA6OPS on the QSO Today search bar in the upper right corner of the website, and you'll find this episode. 73, April, and thanks again.
73.
This concludes my QSO with April. I must tell you that we went on for another hour after the 73. She has very interesting stories, and of course we discussed music and politics. I'm discovering that even as a ham operator now for over 40 years, I never mastered the art of the QSO until now, and how enjoyable it is to meet new hams and learn about them. Maybe that is one of the takeaways from this podcast that will increase your enjoyment of ham radio, and that's finding a clear channel and just having a QSO with a gal or a fellow on the other end. I appreciate all of the messages that I get from you regarding this podcast. I love making these podcasts and appreciate your attention and feedback. If you have not done so, please join our QSO Today community using any of the buttons on the podcast page where we have the show notes for each QSO. I promise not to spam you or give your email address to anyone. I'm beginning to blog more about my QSOs and what I learn. If you have an interest in what I'm writing, just select blog on the navigation bar at the top of the QSO Today homepage. Until next time, this is Eric. 4Z1UG, 73.